You ever feel like you're trying to solve a Rubik's Cube blindfolded when it comes to understanding big issues? That's why we're doing this deep dive today, to give you a clearer picture, faster. We're tackling something that touches all of us, housing policy right here in the U.S.
Yeah, our goal is to sort of distill a complex topic down to the essentials. Think of this as your informed friend explaining what's really going on with housing, how we got here, and maybe some potential ways forward.
And to help us unpack this, we've been listening intently to a recent discussion. It was at the Dole Institute of Politics, featuring two top experts. Kirk McClure, he's professor emeritus from the University of Kansas, and Emily Hamilton, a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center. We've sifted through their insights to bring you the most crucial information.
Our mission here is pretty straightforward. Help you understand what makes housing policy, work effectively. We'll explore the current situation, the history behind it, and the different ideas being kicked around to improve things.
So let's just jump right in. To even think about solutions, we need to get a handle on the problem first. We often hear about a national housing shortage. I think there was a figure like 2.5 million units mentioned. Now, that number is a bit old. So is that still the big picture?
Well, there is definitely still a significant housing shortage, but it's really more about where those shortages are concentrated. They used to be mainly in those, high-cost coastal cities,
Right.
but now we're seeing that pressure spread, places like Boise, Bozeman, Denver, Austin. So the challenge of finding housing people can actually afford, it's becoming much more widespread.
Yeah, and it feels like so many of us are experiencing that squeeze, in our own budgets. Rent just eats up a bigger and bigger slice of income. Makes you wonder, is this shortage the main thing driving up costs, or are there other big factors in play?
And that's really expensive areas. Yeah, the lack of supply is absolutely the primary driver. And a key reason for that limited supply, it comes down to local land use rules.
Ah.
Things like single family zoning, where you can basically only build one house on a lot and minimum lot sizes, they restrict how many homes can be built in a given area. So the fundamental point is, by legally restricting what can be built where, we've sort of inadvertently created this artificial scarcity in places people really want to live.
That makes sense.
And when these rules are applied across a whole region, it's no surprise that even middle and, upper income folks in places like the Bay Area really struggle with housing costs.
Fewer homes allowed just means higher prices.
Yeah, right.
Got it. But okay, the other expert, Kirk McClure, he has a somewhat different take on the national housing picture as a whole, right?
Yes, that's right. While those what do you call the sexy seven metro areas, Boston, New York, DC, Miami, Seattle, San Francisco, LA, maybe San Diego, they certainly have intense shortages. But it's important to remember they aren't really representative of the entire country. We're talking about like hundreds of metropolitan and micropolitan areas. And in his analysis, the majority of these places actually have enough housing or maybe even a
A
surplus.
surplus. Wow. That's surprising, given all the talk about a shortage. What makes them say that?
Well, if you look back at the early 2000s, say from 2000 to 2007, we were building at a pretty high rate, something like 175 homes for every 100 new households formed. That's a lot of building.
Okay.
And while those new homes got occupied, it also meant that a lot of the older housing stock, the stuff that needed investment, kind of lost value. And this contributed to the situation now where we have around 10 million vacant housing units nationwide. That's way more than what's considered a healthy level for, people moving and markets functioning smoothly.
10 million empty homes, that sounds huge.
Huh.
Why doesn't that translate into more affordable housing for everybody then?
That's the crucial point. Because vacancy, just the number itself, can be really misleading. A lot of these vacant units are simply not in good shape. They need major repairs, new roofs, updated kitchens, bathrooms, stuff costing tens of thousands of dollars.
Right, serious money.
Exactly. They might not even pass the basic safety inspections required for programs like Section 8. So while they exist on paper, they aren't really viable options for most people. And often they're clustered in older suburbs or central cities, which unfortunately can depress property values right in those specific areas.
So just because a house is empty doesn't mean it's a real affordable option for someone. It's much more nuanced.
Precisely. And as Emily Hamilton pointed out, there's also what you might call a rental rate floor. Landlords have costs, right? Maintenance taxes, potential renovations. So they won't rent properties below a certain point because it would actually cost them money.
Okay, so we've got potential shortages in high demand spots because of building restrictions, and this surplus of often unusable units in other places. What other big factors are making housing less affordable?
Well, in those areas where it's hard to build, just getting permission, the whole approval process, is a huge hurdle.
Yeah.
Even if a project perfectly fits the existing zoning rules, it can take months, sometimes years, to get all the necessary sign-offs.
Wow, years.
Yeah. And this adds a lot of cost, a lot of uncertainty. That cost ultimately gets passed on to renters and buyers. And, you know, it can just discourage developers from even bothering to try building in the first place.
It sounds like roadblocks at every turn, even before a shovel hits the ground. And Kirk McClure, you mentioned earlier, he talked about cities trying to deal with those vacant homes they hold.
Yes, even when cities have good intentions, they run into these practical problems. He used Kansas City as an example. They have vacant homes in what they call land banks, and they're often willing to sell them super cheap, sometimes just a dollar.
A dollar? Yeah. Seriously.
Yeah, but there are usually strings attached. You might need a lot of cash up front. You have to promise to renovate really quickly, maybe live there for several years. Plus, and this is key, in the neighborhoods where these vacant homes often are, the market might be weak, meaning the cost to fix the place up is actually more than the house would be worth when you're done.
Ouch.
So while regulations are part of it, sometimes the fundamental weakness of the market itself is the bigger barrier. It just doesn't make financial sense to fix them up.
So it's not just the rules. The underlying economics in those areas are a huge factor. Okay, let's focus on the rental market for a minute, because that's where so many people, maybe folks right here in Deer Park, LaPorte, and Pasadena, TX, and definitely across the country, are really feeling that affordability crunch. Kirk McClure said Kansas City is a good example here.
That's right. In Kansas City, and he argued this is true for many similar metro areas, the main issue isn't a lack of rental units overall. It's more of a mismatch between what those units cost and what lower-income households can actually afford.
A pricing mismatch.
Okay.
Yeah. So think about it. A household making, say, under $20,000 a year, to spend a reasonable amount on rent, you know, the standard 30% of income benchmark, they'd need to find a place for under $500 a month.
Right.
But the reality is, it costs landlords significantly more than that just to operate and maintain a decent rental property. So there are very, very few units available at that price point.
So there's this big gap between what's out there and what's truly affordable for a whole segment of the population, including maybe right here in our communities.
Exactly. The rental market, at least in Kansas City, seems to work best for landlords in the maybe $750 to $1,250 per month range. And ironically, McClure pointed out, there are often more units available in that price range than there are households in the $30,000 to $50,000 income bracket who typically need them.
So what happens to the folks with really low incomes?
Well, it forces them to rent those more expensive units, the ones they can't really afford, which means they end up spending, you know, maybe half or even more of their very limited income just on rent.
Wow. That paints a really tough picture of housing insecurity. People constantly having to choose between rent and, you know, food or medicine.
Precisely. So the core problem, in his view, for many places, isn't necessarily a shortage of total units, but the pricing structure. So to address this, you either need to somehow create a lot more units at that very low sub-$500 rent level, which is difficult and expensive,
yeah.
Or you need to help those low-income households be able to afford the existing units in that more common $750 to $1,250 range. And that's where things like housing choice vouchers come into play.
Emily Hamilton, did she see this pricing mismatch problem as something widespread, even where there isn't a huge overall housing shortage?
Absolutely. She agreed that even in areas without major supply shortages, we see serious affordability problems for lower income renters. And she strongly agreed with Kirk that expanding housing choice vouchers is probably the most effective way to tackle this specific issue. These vouchers, they essentially help bridge that gap, right, between what low-income families can afford and the actual market cost of decent housing.
So in some markets, at least, it's maybe more about helping people afford the housing that's already there rather than just building more and more.
Exactly. But, you know, simply increasing the funding for vouchers isn't the whole story. We also need to make the program work better, make it more appealing for landlords to actually participate. Right now, only a small fraction, maybe 1 in 4, of the households who are eligible for vouchers actually receive them because of funding limits.
Only 1 in 4. Wow.
Yeah. And even those who do get a voucher can have a really tough time finding a landlord who will accept it. This can be due to various reasons. Sometimes discrimination, unfortunately, but also just the added administrative steps, the regulations, the red tape that comes with the program.
So landlords might just see it as too much hassle.
It can be, yeah. Which is why Hamilton suggested looking at alternative approaches too, like maybe experimenting with direct cash transfers instead of vouchers, could also provide some valuable insights.
Okay, so it sounds like we need to attack this from multiple angles, looking at both the supply of housing and people's ability to pay for it. Now, let's step back a bit and think about how we even got here. Kirk McClure, with his background in federal housing programs, what's the history? How do we arrive at this point?
Well, federal involvement in housing has really gone through several distinct phases. We started way back with traditional public housing, where the government basically owned, financed, managed, and even chose the locations for housing projects.
Okay.
And, you know, to be honest, the general consensus is it didn't work out very well. It often ended up concentrating poverty in specific areas and sometimes led to the decline of those neighborhoods. We've learned from that, and we're really not building that kind of traditional public housing anymore. In fact, a lot of it is being phased out or redeveloped.
So a shift away from direct government ownership and management then?
Correct. We then moved more towards involving the private sector with programs like Section 8. The idea there was private developers would own and manage the properties, but the government would provide subsidies to help low-income families afford the rent. Generally seen as a better approach, though it's had its own challenges, and funding levels have, you know, gone up and down over the years, particularly declining during the Reagan era.
Right.
Interestingly, we're now seeing some forms of Section 8 assistance, called project-based assistance, being used to help renovate and preserve older affordable properties, including some that were originally financed through another program, the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit.
Ah, yes, the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit. That's another really key piece of the puzzle, isn't it?
It is. It's currently the biggest production program. This program gives tax breaks to developers who agree to keep rents below a certain level for a set period, usually 15 years, sometimes longer. Think of it as a subsidy that encourages developers to offer below market rents.
But how low are those rents typically?
Well, that's the thing. The below market rate often isn't low enough for the very poorest households. Those families are generally better served by vouchers. The tax credit program typically serves households with incomes around, say, $25,000 to $30,000, which is higher than those who usually qualify for vouchers, who might be closer to $15,000.
Okay, so different programs serving slightly different income levels.
Exactly. And the Housing Choice Voucher Program itself, which evolved from the original Section 8, is generally considered the most effective direct assistance program by both experts, McClure and Hamilton. It ensures families pay no more than 30% of their income on rent. It gives them more choice in where they live, at least in theory, and provides a reliable income stream for landlords.
But you said in theory about the choice of where to live.
Yeah, because while that's the goal, the reality is the intended mobility hasn't fully materialized. Voucher holders still sometimes face challenges finding units in higher opportunity neighborhoods. And there's that administrative burden on landlords we talked about, which can be a deterrent. McClure actually noted the tax credit programs might be doing a slightly better job recently at locating units in those high opportunity neighborhoods.
Interesting. And only 1 in 4 eligible families get vouchers now.
That's the estimate, yeah. Due to funding limitations. And the COVID-19 pandemic really brought home the need for a more flexible system, something that could automatically ramp up assistance during big economic downturns like high unemployment to help people stay housed, maybe like temporary rental assistance.
Makes sense. Now, Emily Hamilton, looking at it more from the supply side, what's the historical picture with land use regulations? How have they shaped affordability over time?
Well, zoning rules, as we know them, started about a century ago. And for the first, maybe half of that time, they didn't necessarily cause huge affordability problems across the board. Builders still had access to land, often on the outskirts of cities, where they could build relatively affordable housing.
Greenfield development, they call it.
Right. This new housing, maybe not luxury, but it was within reach for median income families. And then over time, as it aged, it would naturally become more affordable, sort of filtering down. So for a long time, the private market was actually serving a pretty wide range of incomes.
But that changed. What happened?
Yeah, it started to break down, especially in those desirable supply constrained areas, as land use restrictions became more numerous, more complex, longer permitting processes, more hoops to jump through, and as cities sprawled outwards, making development on the edges less appealing due to longer commutes.
Right. Nobody wants a 2-hour commute.
Exactly. So this model of building affordable on the fringe became less viable. More and more households got burdened by high housing costs, long commutes. And interestingly, the environmental movement in the 1970s also played a role. Regulations like single-family zoning were sometimes promoted as being environmentally friendly.
Even though they lead to sprawl.
Right, even though they often led to lower density, car-dependent development patterns that are actually less efficient from an energy and infrastructure perspective. So rules that might have started with good intentions ended up having these, well, unintended consequences for housing costs and even the environment.
So looking ahead then, what are some potential solutions people are talking about? Kirk McClure, what did he think about this idea of filtering? You know, the theory that building more expensive luxury apartments will eventually lower prices for everyone else.
Yeah, he wasn't very optimistic about filter working effectively. The idea, again, is that as wealthier people move into new high-end housing, their older homes become available at lower prices, eventually filtering down to lower-income households. It sounds logical.
But
But the evidence, he argued, suggests it doesn't really work that well in practice. New households are constantly being formed, often at those higher income levels, so they tend to just occupy the units that become available in the next tier down, rather than those units significantly dropping in price to become affordable for truly low-income families.
so just relying on the market to build high-end stuff probably won't solve the affordability problem for everyone at the bottom. And you mentioned earlier that these regulations, the restrictive ones, are often popular. Why is there so much resistance to changing them if they're part of the problem?
Well, because many of these regulations actually benefit specific groups, particularly existing homeowners. They often want to protect their property values and, the character of their neighborhoods. Zoning started as a way to separate different land uses, like industry from homes, but it's evolved in many places into a tool for what you might call socioeconomic sorting. It allows communities to effectively limit who can afford to live there.
So changing things isn't easy.
No. While reducing these regulations could potentially lead to less expensive housing, maybe more environmentally friendly development patterns, better access to opportunities, you can expect strong pushback from those who benefit from the current system. Think about the rise of things like gated communities. That's another form of exclusion.
It's definitely a complicated mix of interests and incentives. Now, Emily Hamilton mentioned Houston. It often comes up as a city with a different approach to land use. Can you tell us about their experience? What might we learn, maybe even for our own communities here, around Southeast Houston, Deer Park, LaPorte, Pasadena?
That's right. Houston's a really interesting case. It's seen huge population growth, but still has a lower median house price compared to many other big cities. Now, it's definitely known for its sprawl, but it also allows for a lot more multifamily housing construction and has implemented some pro-density reforms, especially within the inner parts of the city. They've encouraged building on smaller lots, for example.
They don't have traditional zoning, right?
Correct. Houston is famous for not having comprehensive use-based zoning like most other major U.S. cities. And interestingly, voters there have repeatedly rejected proposals to adopt it over the years. This relative openness to different types of housing, like allowing townhouses on smaller lots in inner areas after they reduced minimum lot sizes, plus having more flexible parking rules, it really seems to have contributed to keeping their housing market more affordable overall, despite the growth.
So maybe a less restrictive approach to land use could be a key factor in keeping housing costs more manageable, even in a growing area like ours. And are we seeing shifts towards reforming these rules elsewhere too?
Yes, definitely. There are some encouraging signs. Cities like Berkeley and Seattle and even the entire state of Oregon have taken steps to loosen some of their restrictive zoning regulations. There's the YMBY movement, yes, in my backyard, which is actively pushing for more housing development, especially in California.
Right, the opposite of in MB.
Exactly. We're seeing some states stepping in to preempt or override certain local single-family zoning rules and allowing things like accessory dwelling units or ADUs, those smaller secondary homes or apartments on existing lots. Minneapolis is another example. They eliminated exclusive single-family zoning altogether, now allowing up to 3 units on any residential lot. These are definitely positive steps towards increasing housing options.
Okay, lots happening on the regulation front. And Kirk McClure, going back to solutions that could maybe be applied locally, you and Emily both highlighted expanding housing choice vouchers. Can you just briefly recap how they work and why they're seen as valuable, maybe even for residents right here?
Sure. So a housing choice voucher basically acts like cash, but it can only be used for rent. Low-income families get the voucher, and they can use it to rent a home from a private landlord in the regular market. There are conditions, of course. The unit has to meet basic health and safety standards. The landlord has to agree to accept the voucher, and the rent has to be deemed reasonable compared to similar units in the area.
And it caps what the family pays.
Yes. The key is the voucher ensures the family typically pays no more than 30% of their adjusted income towards rent and utilities. The voucher covers the difference up to a certain payment standard. While it's a federal program, McClure mentions successful local examples, like one in Lawrence, Kansas, providing temporary vouchers for domestic violence victims to find safe housing quickly. Generally, vouchers are seen as a cost-effective way to address affordability directly, and they often face less local opposition, less NIMBYism, compared to, say, trying to build a new affordable housing project in an established neighborhood.
Makes sense.
And there's even ongoing discussion about the potential and the cost of making housing vouchers universal available to everyone who qualifies based on income.
Now, what about that concern that just flooding the market with more vouchers might just cause rents to spike, especially in certain areas? That's something our listeners might worry about locally.
Yeah. That's a valid concern, and it was raised in the discussion. If voucher holders don't have a wide range of housing options available to them, or if they tend to concentrate in certain neighborhoods, it could potentially lead to localized price increases. But McClure pointed to experiences in other countries like the UK and Australia, which have had more widespread voucher-like programs. Their experience suggests that significant price inflation hasn't really been a major issue, or at least it's been minimal. There was even some evidence that landlords might improve the quality of their properties to attract voucher holders. Of course, he cautioned the U.S. housing market is different, so it's something that would need careful watching.
And can voucher holders pay more if they want a nicer place?
Yes, they can. They have to pay 30% of their income towards rent, but the program allows them to pay up to 40% if they choose to rent a unit that costs more than the standard payment limit. However, relatively few voucher holders actually do this, often because their budgets are already very tight.
Okay. And finally, there was a question about mortgage lending. How do those practices affect housing affordability? That's definitely relevant for aspiring homeowners here. Emily Hamilton had thoughts on that.
Yeah, she pointed to research suggesting that certain aspects of our current mortgage system, specifically the mortgage interest tax deduction, don't necessarily increase the rate of home ownership overall. Instead, it tends to encourage people who are already going to buy homes to maybe buy larger or fancier homes than they otherwise would, which can contribute to pushing up overall housing costs.
Interesting. And Kirk McClure, just briefly, the historical role of mortgage lending.
He touched on how the creation of the Federal Housing Administration, the FHA, and really the development of the standard 30-year fixed-rate mortgage were incredibly important historical steps. They made homeownership much more accessible and stable for a much wider range of Americans than ever before. And institutions like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were crucial in keeping money flowing into that mortgage market.
Wow. Okay, it is crystal clear that when we talk housing policy, we're dealing with a really, really complex web. You've got the supply of homes, the demand, all the regulations shaping what gets built where, and these broader economic forces all tangled together.
Absolutely. And maybe the biggest takeaway is that there's no single one-size-fits-all solution that's going to work everywhere. Different communities, different cities, they face different primary challenges. For some, it really is a fundamental shortage of housing options. For others, it might be more about that disconnect between the cost of the housing that is available and what local residents can actually afford.
But it does sound like there are tools with real potential. Things like housing choice vouchers, thoughtful reforms to land use regulations, maybe learning from places like Houston or looking at these recent state and local initiatives we talked about. These could offer real promise for improving affordability, even right here in Deer Park, LaPorte, and Pasadena.
For sure. It really requires considering a whole range of strategies and tailoring them to the specific needs and circumstances of each community.
All right. So on that note, let's bring it home. Think about the housing situation right here in Deer Park, LaPorte, and Pasadena. Based on everything we've discussed today, what do you see as the most pressing housing issues in our community? Are we mainly facing a shortage of homes overall, or is the bigger challenge that mismatch between housing costs and local incomes? And maybe more importantly, what potential actions could residents take locally to start addressing these issues? Maybe drawing on some of these national trends and policy ideas we've unpacked, it really is all about understanding that bigger picture and then focusing on how we can potentially make a difference right here where we live. If you found value in this deep dive today and want to help us keep providing actionable information for our Southeast Houston community, please do consider supporting us at thinkandactlocally.com/donate. You'll find that link in the show notes.